Welcome to Counselor Audio Source. Counselor Audio Source is a regular podcast dedicated to the professional enhancement of practicing counselors, supervisors, and counselor educators. Look for us on the web at counselorautosource.net. In this Counselor Audio Source podcast, Dr. Jill Geltner interviews Dr. Catherine Adams, both assistant professors of psychology and counseling at Valdosta State University, regarding the response to intervention model for working with school success.
Hi, my name is Jill Geltner, and I'm here with Dr. Catherine Adams to talk about response to intervention model, otherwise known as RTI. And first thing I'd like to do, Dr. Adams, is just have you tell me a little bit about yourself.
Well, I'm currently assistant professor at Valdosta State University in Valdosta, Georgia. I'm part of the master's level clinical counseling program here in the Department of Psychology, and I'm actively involved in the training of clinical counselors as well as school psychologists. So I teach a lot of courses about intellectual assessment, legal and ethical issues in psychology. My background in education is I come from a combined program at Florida State University, and I graduated with a doctorate degree in counseling psychology and school psychology. So my background and my education allows me to cross from the clinical side of psychology into the school systems a little bit. So it served me well.
Great. And I understand you also have some experience working as a teacher.
Yes. I actually started out my undergraduate education was in teaching. So I have 4 years experience in the public school system.
Great. So you can really look at this from the teacher perspective as well as the school psychologist perspective.
Yes.
Okay. As we begin, if you could just sort of briefly describe to me what, for those who may not be at all familiar, what the response to intervention model is.
Well, very simply, the response to intervention model, or RTI, which is commonly known as, is a systems-wide school improvement model, and it was designed to provide high-quality instruction and behavioral support to students within a general education setting. So within this model, students are given an appropriate level of instruction based on their individual academic or behavioral needs using this multi-tiered method of service delivery. The assumption behind RTI is that most students will be able to achieve successfully if they're given high-quality instruction within the general classroom. However, there may be some students that continue to struggle in the general curriculum, and they may need additional types of instruction. And an even smaller number of students may have more intensive needs requiring even more specialized instructions.
Okay.
Some authors in the literature have summarized the philosophy of RTI as determining which children need what services delivered with how much intensity. And if the student's needs are greater than that can be offered within the general education, the child may be eligible to receive additional services through special ed.
Okay, so sort of looking at the student, what they need individually, and then getting more intense with those services, waiting sort of to see more success for those who are struggling.
Correct.
Makes sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And where did it come from? It's relatively new in schools compared to sort of the deficit model, looking at students who struggle. Sort of, I guess, what caused in the history in the last, you know, decade or so for it to be examined, for that to be examined differently?
Well, in terms of how it came to be, it was likely due to a culmination of factors. For one, practitioners were already growing increasingly frustrated with the current practices of waiting for a student to fail before services could be provided. Right. So there was already this increasing frustration with the current system. But then in 2002, President Bush's No Child Left Behind initiative was passed into law by Congress. So this law made public schools more accountable for student achievement. So they felt a lot of pressure to find a more preventative approach. And then the reauthorized version of the Individuals with Disabilities in Education Act, or IDEA, that President Bush signed into law in 2004, allowed school districts to use RTI to identify learning disabilities, bringing further attention to this approach. So those initiatives, combined with the just increasing frustration of the practitioners, really propelled RTI into the forefront of what we see today.
So would you say overall it's kind of a shift in perspective? People were frustrated of kids having to really do very poorly before they could get help, to sort of looking at it in a more proactive way.
Correct. A more preventative approach.
Okay. So what theoretical approach would you say the RTI model is a reflection of?
Well, as I mentioned, RTI is that systems-level approach to prevention. So the multiple tiers or levels of intervention are similar to the public health model of primary, secondary, and tertiary interventions, which really isn't a new concept at all. That preventative model, that public health model, has been around for a long time. So if we look at it within this public health model, tier one of RTI may be viewed as a primary intervention that's intended for all students in the general curriculum or school. Then students who need more instruction or a stronger intervention are provided a secondary level of intervention at tier two. And finally, the tertiary tier is for those students needing the most intense of all available interventions.
So would you call the primary intervention that you speak of, or the first intervention, that's just basic teaching?
It's basic teaching, but we have to ensure that teachers provide quality instruction. That's the key to RTI.
Okay, so are you talking about maybe the skilled teacher versus the teacher that just might give students something to do independently?
It definitely has something to do with teacher skill, but it also involves providing instruction to students that is empirically based, meaning that there is research support to show that the type of curriculum that's being used within the general education system has been proven effective to facilitate student success.
Okay. So we're assuming that that primary intervention is just what all good teaching should be taking place in the schools. So it's not necessarily that we're watching every single teacher do every single thing, just we assume that's taking place, or we check to make sure that is before we move on to a more intense intervention.
Sure.
Okay. So we using the word intervention a lot within the RTI model, what per se is the intervention, quote unquote?
Okay. As we've already alluded to, one key feature of RTI is the multiple tiers or multiple levels of supports. And different authors in the literature advocate for a different number of tiers. Usually it's between two and four, but the most common model described is a three-tiered model. So although the intervention or instruction may vary in intensity from tier to tier based on student need, all interventions remain evidence-based, meaning that there is empirical research to support the intervention's effectiveness in promoting student achievement.
As you said, it's sort of a tried-and-true type of intervention or teaching strategy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. And when we're moving on to a secondary intervention, it's the same kind of an idea, just another different approach to teaching, mm-hmm. the same that might not have worked initially for that student.
Right. If we had to kind of describe how these tiers work, basically it's the school's responsibility to ensure high-quality classroom instruction before students are moved up to a higher tier to receive more intense instruction or are singled out to receive special services. So the types of interventions or services that are provided at the higher tiers are largely determined by the individual school districts. Some schools may choose to implement what's called a standard approach to remediate academic difficulties in students who aren't successful with the Tier 1 general instruction. For example, those students identified as low achievers in a particular subject, let's say reading, may receive a standard amount of additional instruction, let's say 30 minutes of additional reading instruction or so in a smaller group setting. So that would constitute Tier 2. Okay. Other schools may implement what's often referred to as a problem-solving approach, which focuses on creating individualized instructions for each student. Or you could even combine the approaches into a combined protocol, which incorporates features of both the standard protocol and the problem-solving approaches. So, for example, let's say a student is struggling in reading within the general curriculum. The teacher decides that they might need to be moved up to a higher tier, so she'll implement a standard protocol at Tier 2, where they receive additional reading instruction in a small group for about 8 weeks. And then she'll monitor that student's progress to see if they respond to that additional small group instruction. If the child is deemed a non-responder, then they may receive more individualized problem-solving approach to instruction at a higher tier for about 8 weeks.
Okay, so just to sort of simplify it in more layman's terms, a child who's struggling in reading with an approach that is proven to be successful with a number of students, which would then be the primary. If there's a student that's still struggling, then they may try one of these secondary interventions, which could be the combined that you spoke of, or else just the smaller group or an individualized. And then after a certain number of times, you said 8 weeks?
Well, typically, yeah, it usually lasts between 6 and 10 weeks of intervention to determine whether or not it has been proven effective.
If it's helping the
right.
child. Okay, so how, I guess, then, would you know if the student responded to that intervention, that secondary or more intense?
Okay. Well, to answer that question adequately, let's backtrack a little bit. I just want to bring attention to another fundamental principle of RTI, and that's database decision making. That's the key to determining whether or not a child is responding to an intervention or not. So in other words, the RTI model uses data collected from a variety of different types of assessments to place students into appropriate tiers, first of all, and then to monitor the student's progress to determine how well they're responding to that instruction. So schools can vary on the specific assessment tools they use, how often they assess, and who is responsible for the assessment. But all should engage in frequent and ongoing assessment so that they can respond quickly if a child starts to fall behind. In addition to the data collection, schools typically establish a process for determining if a student has responded to the intervention. And most schools will create some school-based team of individuals from various disciplines. It can include school psychologists, Title I teachers, social workers, both general and special education teachers, might all make up this team, but then that team is responsible for reviewing the data and then making instructional decisions about that student.
Okay, so in other words, everything that's done along the way, we're measuring to see if there's real student progress. We're not just saying, okay, the child got it or didn't get it anecdotally. We're really measuring, and then as a group, lots of different professionals are coming together and saying, okay, has this worked for little Johnny in reading class?
Right. The teachers are constantly monitoring the student's progress while they're engaging in the intervention. The key is not to wait until the intervention is completed, but, you know, we want to find out how the student is progressing during the intervention to intervene as early as possible.
Okay. No, so that's a good point. So we're not necessarily going this 6 to 10 weeks and then doing a test at the end, sort of ongoing to see if there's improvement. But the time frame tells us, okay, we want to go at least this long before we decide, okay, this hasn't worked.
Right, correct. You know, and there's a lot of different ways of judging whether or not a student has responded to an intervention. Some school teams might set a criterion, or some might measure the rate of growth that student is making. But one of the most straightforward and popular ways of determining if a student is responding to an intervention is to graph the data. So we would actually draw an aim line based on the data points, and then we would use a three-point decision rule to determine if a student has responded to the intervention. So if we go back to our earlier example about a child struggling in reading, we would develop an intervention that would, over time, aim to remediate the child's skills to grade-level expectations. Now, ideally, if we graphed the trajectory of the child's progress, the child's achievement aim line would eventually meet grade level expectations. Okay, the two lines would meet on the graph. But
ideally, that is.
Ideally, of course. But as we continue to assess and graph the child's progress, if the child has three consecutive data points that fall below the aim line, that might mean that he's not responding to that intervention as we would have hoped, so he may be considered a non-responder. So in that case, the observed trajectory may not ever reach grade level expectations within the time frame that we had set.
So we may see improvement, but it may not be significant enough, or we may see that they just need more time. Clearly, it's going to be based on how that individual child does. And then this team that you spoke of would look at that data and then talk about what the next step should be based on that particular student.
Correct, yes.
Okay. Now, we're talking in terms of sort of that secondary intervention, and I know there could be a third or a fourth intervention. But how... if we determine that this child is not meeting the aim line, is that what you mean? If the child is not sort of showing the improvement that we would expect or that we would hope based on these good teaching strategies, is there still a way for the student to be channeled into a special needs or special education environment if we determine that that really is what seems to be needed for him?
That is a great question. You know, when should a referral for special education services be placed? At what point
do we go ahead and...
Right. And that answer depends on the number of tiers within the system, like you said. How many tiers is the system implementing? But typically, referral for special education occurs when a student doesn't respond to interventions offered at Tier 2 or Tier 3. Okay, so the problem, though, is that the criteria for judging a student as a non-responder is sometimes determined locally at the school or the district level, or at least state by state. So there's a lot of variability in how these agencies determine how much intervention is enough before making a referral to special ed. If you look into the literature, the exact percentages vary somewhat. But Grisham estimates that about 80-90% of students are likely to respond successfully to the general curriculum at Tier 1. Okay, so most students should respond to that quality instruction. About 5-10% may need Tier 2 supports. Okay, so they're going to move on up to Tier 2. But then only about 1.5% may need even more intensive intervention at Tier 3. So in this case, only about 1.5% of students would even be considered for special education services. So basically, a referral for special education is only made when it's determined that a student's needs exceed the services that can be offered in the general education.
Okay. So it's interesting because my next question was about how this is a shift from the previous model, or the kind of wait-to-fail model, as it's been called, the deficit model. And I think that maybe the first part of that answer is that it is a much smaller percentage of students that ultimately are considered for special education services.
Correct. The deficit model has been highly criticized for over-identifying students with disabilities for special education. So that is one of the criticisms that the proponents of RTI do hope to address by implementing this system on a large scale. You know, unfortunately, the deficit model has also been criticized as a wait-to-fail model because students have to experience failure over a period of time before they're referred for testing. And then, you know, even if young students are referred for a teacher or by a teacher for testing, a severe enough discrepancy between IQ and achievement, which is a qualification for special ed under this model, may not be evident until about the third grade. So again, you know, if they're referred early, they're not going to qualify for special ed until the severity of the discrepancy increases, and that only comes with time. There's a lot of research to support that criticism. Studies show that the odds of being classified as learning disabled increases from the first to the fourth grade dramatically.
So we're kind of just waiting for that child to get further behind and the gap to widen so that he may become eligible for services.
Right, right.
Less proactive.
The delivery of services is delayed until they have a severe enough discrepancy or they have failed severely enough and long enough.
Yeah, that doesn't seem like the way to go. Okay. I know one of the criticisms of RTI has been that it can be a very lengthy process. Not that the old method was so expedient, but how long can the process typically take? I'm sure it can vary from child to child or teacher to teacher, classroom to classroom. But
right.
Well,
in a way, you know, the old discrepancy model was called the wait to fail model, but in a way, RTI can be considered the wait to respond model if you wanted to look at it that way. You know, the process basically takes just as long as it takes to document through ongoing assessment whether a child is responding or not responding to a particular intervention.
And however many tears.
And that, yeah, that can vary on the frequency of assessment and the severity of the student's academic difficulties. So while the progress monitoring timeline can vary, you know, still consistent with the RTI principles, formative assessment, which is ongoing assessment of student progress, is occurring to guide the instructional placement decision. So it can just vary based on so many different factors.
So it is similar to the old model in that it varies by intervention, by teacher, and by the child for what that child needs.
Right, but hopefully it doesn't preclude those younger students that are manifesting problems earlier on.
Right.
You know, we can intervene earlier with them.
Okay. The other difference that I'm noticing from RTI and the old approach is sort of that ship the child off to the school psychologist in a little office to have some sort of testing. This seems to be more of a shift to examining the student within the classroom or examining specifically what teaching strategies are used in the classroom.
Right. Teachers and staff are going to assume a much more active role in the student's assessment, you know, within that general education curriculum, that they're not going to be so reliant on, you know, the school psychologist testing the student anymore. The school psychologist is no longer the gatekeeper for special education services. Within this RTI model, students are only referred to the school psychologist for testing after they've been identified as a non-responder. And they're only referred to the school psychologist so that the team of professionals who are making these intervention decisions can be given more information about the student's functioning to help develop more appropriate interventions within that problem-solving approach. So the school psychologist, you know, no longer provides the numbers that dictate whether or not the child receives special education. Now they're providing information to tailor the interventions to the student.
So it's a much more cooperative effort, and with everyone involved sort of from start to finish to create the best case scenario for that child to succeed before we decide, okay, they're not going to be capable of whatever the normal students would be. Okay. So as we're talking about looking at the way teachers teach and the way the classroom runs, how is RTI then? I'm seeing it as something that could benefit all the students if we're talking about improving teaching.
Yes, it is a systems level approach, and we want to provide that quality instruction to all students within general education. So if students are provided with quality instruction, it increases the likelihood of their success. And on the other hand, it's going to rule out the possibility that poor instruction is the cause of poor performance. So in that way, it definitely benefits all students within the classroom or within the school or across the district. By monitoring the effectiveness of the classroom instruction, one would hope to prevent academic problems from occurring. But if the student does fall behind, the teachers are able to identify the problem and intervene early. So in the end, yes, all students will benefit from that instruction.
That's certainly, that change in the system certainly is a very positive thing. Although it's a different way to approach things, and maybe some might struggle against doing something new, that is clearly a positive. To play devil's advocate for a second, we all know that there are some teachers out there that might struggle with something new, or psychologists, or administrators, or systems in general, we know, sometimes resist change. What do we do in that school or in that classroom with a teacher who's maybe unwilling to try this new approach or unsure of what to do?
Well, I guess with any type of change, there's bound to be some resistance.
Of course, of course.
Some people get a little uneasy when they're asked to step outside their comfort zone, especially when they're not sure of what their expected role in the change process looks like. And I think that's where a lot of resistance comes from. That's why professional development and in-service trainings for teachers, as well as other faculty and staff, will be extremely important in bringing about this type of systems level change. Teachers play such an integral role in RTI, so they have to be prepared to offer that proven instructional strategies and intervention, and they have to be trained in how to measure and evaluate student growth. Mm-hmm. And we can't take it for granted that they already know how to do that. In addition, collaboration is going to be an important part of this process. Collaboration between teachers in the general education curriculum, as well as special education and other specialists. Everyone has to work as a team because all are accountable now for a child's progress.
So I'm just thinking as someone who trains school counselors, I'm just thinking about the role of the school counselor. Much like the role would be in special education. And so we're looking at sort of just trying to coordinate the services with all the different specialists in the school and bringing everybody together to sort of problem solve in the likely event that someone doesn't know what to do. The school system hopefully is providing training. And maybe the school psychologist would certainly end up as the leader in this effort, but that those who would be involved in the old process, which would be the special education teacher, administrators, what have you, would be sort of a similar approach. Let's all just get together and talk about what's going on with this kid and see what we can do to help him in the classroom catch up with everything.
Collaboration is key, and each individual within the school system will come at the problem from a different perspective. So the different perspectives can come together to create one of the more effective types of interventions.
Okay, well, great. So you touched on this a little bit earlier, but at what age or what ages is RTI best used with? And certainly the benefit that we can start with a younger child and sort of assist in that way. What would sort of be the ideal place to start?
Well, most of the research that we currently have about the effectiveness of RTI is based on early readers, like pre-kindergarten through the third grade. That's where the majority of our research comes from. But the research isn't quite as sound for older students or for students struggling in different academic areas. And to be honest, up to this point, there's been very little done at the middle or high school levels. So right now, we're talking about early intervention. So the younger the student it is, the more research support we have for that effectiveness.
Okay. So it's like many other interventions for kids that are struggling. Early intervention is showing the best improvement for those kids. And when you say that the research base is stronger for the younger children, it's not necessarily terrible for the older kids. There's just more to support it in the younger age groups.
Right. It's just that RTI is so new. Mm-hmm. Well, the concept isn't new. It has been used in different states for quite some time, but there's not a lot of research support. It's just catching on in many parts of our country, so there's not a lot of research to show the long-term effectiveness of RTI. We just have to wait until more is done.
Right, and if we're looking at middle and high school students, they may have already been identified in a different way, and it's kind of hard to tease out what's... Is there a specific difficulty that a child might face or specific disability, I guess, that this model is not ideal?
Well, theoretically, RTI principles should work with most difficulties that students face in the classroom, because the focus now is on providing a tailored intervention to meet the student's specific need. And there is professional support for using RTI with children experiencing all sorts of academic, emotional, and behavioral problems. For example, there's considerable support for the use of RTI in determining specific learning disabilities. The rationale behind that is that diagnosing learning disabilities in using RTI will work because learning disabilities are thought to be due to intrinsic differences, maybe like more neurological type problems. So if the student is given quality instruction and they're still not responding, then their difficulties have to be due to some other factor, right? Okay. So it's more likely to tease out those intrinsic differences. RTI is also thought to be an improvement over the old way of making eligibility determinations for students with emotional and behavioral difficulties. The actual definition of emotional disability is vague, and yes. And at times it can be somewhat contradictory. So making an eligibility determination is difficult. So unlike the current practices, RTI requires intervention prior to rather than after eligibility determination. So students with these emotional or behavioral problems are getting the intervention that they need despite being eligible or deemed having a disability.
So in other words, what we can say is because it's individually tailored, hypothetically, it could be tailored to suit anybody in any problem area.
Correct.
Great. Is there an example you could give us for looking at using RTI with a student with behavior or emotional difficulties?
Oh, let's see. Let's say a child is in the classroom and he has some common problems of what we'd see, you know, with attention or hyperactivity within the classroom, and the teacher is having a real hard time getting him to pay attention to his academics or remain in his seat when expected or refrain from talking with the students, you know, during instruction, you know, this typical disruptive type behaviors. And he's just not responding to her overall classroom management strategies that she uses for the entire class. So what she would have to do is she would have to first try to provide additional behavioral support for that student within the classroom. So she might come up with an individual behavior management program for this particular student, whether it be self-monitoring his behavior or whether it be an individual systems of rewards or positive reinforcements for that student, and see if that would work first, right? That would constitute a tier two behavioral intervention. You know, monitor his progress with that additional behavioral support. If it still doesn't work, then we would have to move that child up to level three, you know, come up with maybe a more intensive type of behavioral intervention. And again, you would just go through that same process as if you would with an academic problem before being referred.
So again, the baseline of what the teacher is already doing to manage the group is considered that primary intervention.
Right.
And this child that's disruptive needs the secondary intervention, which will be some sort of a plan.
Mm-hmm.
And then we evaluate whether or not that would work after a certain amount of time and decide what if it's working, great. If it's not, maybe we need to come up with a tertiary.
Right. Tier three.
Great. As I mentioned earlier, that changes in the system, of course, can be difficult for some. What would be some of the criticisms that people have made of the RTI approach?
Well,
just give you an opportunity to address that.
Yeah, well, you look in the literature, you find a lot more people in support of RTI right now rather than criticisms. But, you know, there have been a few. One criticism is that while the general principles of RTI are relatively consistent, the model may be implemented differently in different locations. So the RT model looks somewhat variable. So because of that, there can be some confusion about how to effectively implement it across settings. You know, the principles of RTI remain the same, but different schools, different districts, different states may take those principles and translate it into practice a little bit differently. So that can cause some confusion, and I think that's where a lot of the confusion lies right now with it being so new to a lot of areas. Additionally, you know, we have an adequate research base to help us understand some aspects of implementing RTI, like I said, how to intervene with young readers, right? We have a large research base there, but still we have so many questions that have been unexplored up until this point. So, you know, for example, how will RTI work with other subject areas? How will it look once students get into middle school or high school? We'll just have to build up our research base in order to have our questions adequately answered.
Okay. Great. And I'm just envisioning a situation where a child maybe in the midst of the process changes districts or changes schools. I imagine that would be complicated as well, because the teachers then have to sort of see what's been done before and how to complement that based on what techniques they're using at their school for teaching whatever subject area that might be. Okay, let's see. I was going to ask you to describe how the intervention would go from start to finish, but I kind of feel like we've talked about that. Is there anything you wanted to add about that? I think we kind of talked about the different interventions and how long it would take. In a reading model, maybe you could describe to me the child that's going through, say we jump in at stage two, what a real success would look like, and how we would then stop the intervention, or I don't know what word to use to describe that.
Right. Okay. So, okay, let's say that that in kindergarten, okay, the kindergarten class is implementing, you know, high quality, empirically based instruction to all students. But let's say they do a screening at the beginning of the year and they identified that maybe 4 students are kind of falling behind in their reading skills and they're having a hard time with letter sounds. Okay, so the teacher does implement a tier 2 intervention for those 4 students. Let's say she decides that she's going to provide an additional 30 minutes of small group instructions for those students using an intervention that has been proven to help students learn letter sounds. Okay, so she's implementing that small group instruction at tier 2. And then over the next 6 weeks, she continues to test and record the progress of the students at least once a week to see whether or not they're understanding the letter sounds, whether their understanding of the letter sounds is improving with the small group instruction. And the results of that progress monitoring show that 3 of the 4 students are learning an average of, let's say, 2 letter sounds per minute each week. Okay. And so the teacher considers that good. That's good progress. So she determines that she's using the right kind of instruction for them. So for those 3 students, that would be all that's necessary, right? The level 2 intervention is deemed effective. They're considered responders. Mm-hmm. So, you know, once they've been remediated to grade level expectations, they would fall back into the general curriculum.
Okay, so they would discontinue that extra instruction.
Right, if it was deemed no longer necessary.
They responded.
Yeah. Okay. But, you know, there's always that 4th child mm-hmm. that didn't respond. So the teacher would then need to figure out, okay, well, what other kind of instruction should be used with this particular child, and then develop a tier 3 maybe for just that 1 child that didn't respond at tier 2.
So then in that scenario you're describing, so that 2nd tier intervention, do we then discontinue that when we move on to the 3rd tier?
Yes, we would. For that student that didn't respond at tier 2, right, we would have to come up with a more intensive or specialized type of instruction.
So that other way of teaching, for lack of a better way to describe it, hasn't worked for him either. So let's try something else
right.
that's more intensive. And what can teachers and school counselors and other administrators, how can they be helpful with this shift?
Okay. Well, general educators are going to be one of the most important people. They're going to play one of the most important roles within this RTI framework. I mean, if you think about what they're actually required to do, they're required to implement high-quality instruction within the classroom. They're going to be expected to design and implement different types of assessments. And then when difficulties are encountered, the general curriculum teachers are going to have to work collaboratively with other types of professionals. And that's where their role will come in. You know, whether it be special education teachers or Title I teachers or school psychologists or school mm-hmm. counselors, all of these individuals are going to need to assist and collaborate with the special education teachers to develop and implement and evaluate different types of interventions that are designed to meet the students' needs. All of these other professionals will also be able to assist in early screening or leading small groups of instruction within the classroom, interpreting data. Mm-hmm. On a very practical level, teachers are already reporting about how their school guidance counselors in particular are playing an important role in supporting teachers. If you think about how the structure of the teacher's day plays out versus the guidance counselor, sometimes, given the guidance counselor's more flexible schedule, they may be able to step in or assist with progress monitoring. So that's just one very practical way that's been reported so far in how teachers are being supported by the other professionals within the school.
That's good to hear. That's nice. Okay. So I guess my next overall question is, we know this model has been the emerging model for a number of years, and many school districts have mandated its use. How widespread has it been accepted, and sort of has the shift been taken to using the RTI model? And if, like you and I and other schools, universities that are training new educators, how important would it be for new educators to understand the RTI model and have sort of a working knowledge of what it is?
Well, there definitely is a national trend right now towards the RTI model. And like I said, part of that is because RTI seems to be a really good fit for meeting the demands of No Child Left Behind and the reauthorization of IDEA. We just are being held more accountable for student progress, and so we have to find a model that allows us to do that. And RTI seems to be a good fit. So because of these different legal mandates and requirements, most states currently allow the use of either RTI or the discrepancy model in identifying children with special needs. But, you know, some states such as Colorado and West Virginia, they plan to eliminate the discrepancy model altogether in favor of RTI. And others like Florida and Indiana have also proposed doing so. So some states are going purely RTI. I recently ran across a very interesting descriptive study that surveyed the directors of special education in each of the 50 state departments and the District of Columbia. And they found that of the 44 states that responded, all reported that they were either currently implementing or are considering implementing some form of RTI. Some form of RTI model. So when you consider that national trend, you know, I think it's safe to say that new educators will need to have at least some working knowledge of RTI in order to be prepared. It's happening.
It's happening. It needs to be embraced. Okay. On sort of another note, and just in closing, because it's so new and often, parents and families are sort of the last to know in these kind of situations. How has the general response been from families or, you know, those who really care about these kids that are struggling?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we already talked about how, you know, some, you know, school administrators and teachers have mixed feelings about RTI. You know, there's some resistance already at the local level. And part of that is because people are having difficulty just understanding and accepting their change in roles. You know, professionals are having to reconceptualize what it means to be a regular education teacher, or what it means to be a special education teacher or a school psychologist. We're not really sure how that's going to look or what that's going to mean. But from what I've read in terms of the response from parents, their opinions have also been somewhat mixed, just because they don't understand what RTI is going to look like either, or what it's going to mean for their particular child. Many parents of low achieving students feel that someone has finally taken responsibility for their child and they're actually going to do something about remediating their child's difficulties. So there are parents that are embracing RTI in a positive way, while other parents are concerned with how RTI fits into the legal process that's created by IDEA. So again, the response from parents has been mixed, kind of how it has been among professionals within the school system. There are still so many unanswered questions about how to implement RTI and what the long-term impact of the new model will be. And taking a wait-and-see approach makes some people nervous.
It's sort of the old issue is that something new sometimes is scarier than what we already know.
Right.
Right. Well, sounds like whether we like it or not, it's sort of the trend and the way things are going in all states and in all school districts. So I really appreciate you spending the time helping us try to understand it a little bit better. Maybe we can learn to embrace it and see how we can help more kids at younger ages.
Yeah, it's been my pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
You've just heard a podcast of Dr. Catherine Adams regarding the response to intervention model. Look for previous podcasts, show notes, and listener feedback at the podcast website, counselaraudiosource.net. Listeners can leave comments for guests or hosts through our Skype.com internet telephone ID, Counselor Audio Source. Counseling techniques and interventions discussed in the Counselor Audio Source broadcast are meant for use by counseling professionals, and Counselor Audio Source is not held liable for any of the techniques mentioned in the program. Our music bed today is More Red Than Red by Derek K. Miller. His and other PodSafe music can be found in the PodSafe Music Network at podshow.com. Counselor Audio Source is licensed under the Creative Commons, a nonprofit organization offering flexible copyright for creative work.